You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 16th to the 22nd of November 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, reporters Holly Elson, Rachel Pells, and data editor Simon Baker. Sexual assault is endemic in the university sector. Unfortunately, this will not come as news to many within the academy, but with the allegations against Harvey Weinstein unleashing a flood of tales of sexual assault, our cover feature this week sees five scholars shedding light on what they have seen and indeed experienced while working in higher education. John will have more on that piece in just a second. Our lead news story this week focuses on the success rate for grant proposals at the UK Research Councils. Rachel will fill us in on that, while elsewhere in the news section, David Lammy MP has been speaking to Holly about how UK universities could take a leaf out of their US counterparts' books if they want to help those from disadvantaged backgrounds get into university. And which universities across the world produce the most employable graduates? We this week published a 2017 Global University Employability Ranking, and with it a great deal of analysis that Simon will bring us towards the end of the podcast. But first, our cover feature this week, John. It's entitled Cultures of Denial, and it looks at sexual assault within the academy.
Yeah, and I suppose this is the topic of the moment, isn't it? And obviously every industry, I think, is having a very hard look at what does or doesn't go on and the extent to which sexual harassment is an issue that's being dealt with and is understood, and that there are the routes to report and deal with issues that are almost inevitable in a sector of the scale and type of higher education. But I think what we've tried to do here is get five quite different perspectives from women in the UK and North America about certainly first-person testimony of the experiences that they and colleagues have gone through. But also perspectives on why some of the structures in higher education in particular are prone to abuse or abusive behaviour. And certainly a lot of the discussion that goes on beyond the actual incidents that are reported, some of which are absolutely horrifying to read about. And I realise, of course, that I'm speaking from a male perspective, and you sort of read the stuff and find it extraordinary that it goes on. I'm sure a lot of female readers in particular, that's not exclusively a male female issue, won't be a surprise, but when you get beyond the sort of anecdotes and the issue and the specific examples that are discussed, a lot of patterns of behaviour come through there. Certain points in academic career structures are particularly where people are particularly vulnerable. So, for example, the point at which a PhD student transitions into a postdoc, we all know about the issues around temporary contracts and how hard and competitive it is to make your career as a young academic. This is an area that Holly's covered for many years for Times Higher and has written about a great deal, the instability and insecurity in the career structure there. And the extent to which higher education has these, what one person who's writing for us describes as sort of feudal systems in place, where the issues of patronage and more senior colleagues with particular cachet and indeed control over the careers of younger people, the extent to which that is open to abuse and clearly, you know, is being abused, and how universities are or aren't dealing with that in an effective way. So I think it's a really powerful feature, really gets to grips with some of the issues that are out there, and is something that hopefully everybody will read and reflect on what universities could and should be doing differently.
I guess one of the things that stood out for me in the piece was one of the contributors talking about how staying silent is sort of a survival mechanism for a lot of women. And I think that's something that will definitely resonate with the readers who are perhaps at the earlier stages of their career, because, you know, in every kind of abuse there's a power differential, and these researchers have no power in that situation. You know, they might not have a job in 6 months' time unless they sweet-talk the person who is perhaps treating them badly and does the work that they want them to do and doesn't complain. And that's, I guess, a situation that's perpetuated by the structures in academia, as John said.
Indeed, yeah, the untouchables at the top and the very fragile at the bottom, and indeed quite cliquey, a lot of these sort of subject areas, people being forced to see the same people time and time again. If you work with someone once, there's a good chance you are going to come into contact with them again, and a lot of those stories sort of report on how people have been put into some very uncomfortable positions. I'll let you read the piece yourself. It's on page 37 of the magazine. You'll also find it on timeshighereducation.com. Just click the features tab there. If you click the news tab, of course, you'll find our news stories. And our lead story this week, Rachel, is from you, and it's a regular feature for THE each year. It focuses on the success rate for grant proposals at UK research councils. What are the top lines this year?
This year, success rates have gone up by 1%. Success rates being the grant proposals that researchers put in from universities. 1% doesn't sound like much, but it's reversing a five-year downward trend. The amount of cash that's been handed out has also increased this year, which it's been suggested to me that's a good sign, but I think research councils are perhaps hesitant to say so, because there's a lot of variability year to year within individual research councils as well.
So it sounds like good news. More, you know, academics more likely to get the money that they're asking for. You also produced there a sort of list of the institutions that are getting that money. Oxford is top again. I think that's been the case for a few years. UCL, Cambridge, Imperial. The usual suspects?
More or less, although while Oxford, UCL, Cambridge, Imperial do tend to sit at the top in terms of the amount of money received, there are a few universities that have jumped up quite significantly this year. So Sheffield is one. It's in 10th place this year. It's got gained just over £40 million. It's jumped up four places on last year. But the university said that's as a result of targeted support for funding applications. So some universities are perhaps making research grant proposals a focus.
I think the one that stands out for me is Leeds. There's always been a big six that we've typically had in this table. And they are Oxford, UCL, Cambridge, Imperial, Manchester and Edinburgh. And this year Leeds has forced its way into that top six, pushing Edinburgh down. I think looking at the table, it's got a percentage point change in success rate of 9 percentage points, which is really big year on year. So that's a significant mover within the top few.
It's worth remembering, of course, this isn't really scaled for size. So obviously the really big research intensive like UCL is always going to do very well just because it's so such a large university and a research university, whereas they're all obviously large research intensives in the top, but if you look further down the list you might see some universities that have done very well even though they are smaller. So it's worth looking at the full table, which I think is online.
Yeah, indeed. Well, this year, glad you mentioned it, you can actually search that table for the first time.
Yeah.
I know you've had a hand in the technology behind it.
So that sounded like a really personal plug. But yeah.
Yes, you spent a lot of time, Simon. Everyone should head over.
Go online and search for your university in our new interactive table.
Well, to be fair, if you are an academic listening to this, that probably is exactly what you will want to do. So do head over to timeshighereducation.com and you can dig into those numbers a lot more deeply. Elsewhere in news, a recent story, Holly, MP David Lammy, really took Oxford to task, found out that nearly one in three Oxford colleges admitted no black British A-level students in 2015. It made a lot of waves in the press. You've been speaking to him.
Yeah, he invited me over to Portugal's house to talk about the response that he has had from both institutions, Oxford and Cambridge, in result of these statistics that he released to the press, which was covered quite extensively just about a month ago. And he really wanted to talk about how disappointed he was that he has not heard from Oxford as a result of this. So after they set out the data, Mr Lammy and 108 other MPs signed a letter and sent them to both Oxford and Cambridge, sort of describing what they'd found. And so far Oxford has yet to respond to him, which he thinks is actually unacceptable.
Didn't give him the time of day.
And he received a response from Cambridge, which was an email from the Vice-Chancellor. But, he sort of rightly raises the point here that actually these universities are the UK's most prestigious and they really should be leading the pack on these issues. Yet they just seem to be burying their head in the sand and blaming everyone apart from themselves. Oxford did respond to us when we asked them, what's going on? Why haven't you replied to this letter? And they told us that they wanted to look at the
data individually for each of the MPs who had signed the letter's constituency in terms of how much they're spending on outreach and how effective it is. So I guess they will be writing to them at some point to,
well, you'd think so now,
to address the letter.
Yes. I suspect now that you've given them a nudge as well, they might be more likely to. Sorry, go on, John.
Well, I mean, I think this was a really strong interview from Holly and from David Lammy. I think the thing that really struck me is he was really laying into universities for passing the buck. You know, this sense that actually it's always somebody else's fault, it's the school system's fault, the issue is too entrenched by the time it reaches the university's door and there's nothing they can do about it. And, you know, that does ring true to a certain extent. I'm not sort of laying this allegation at Oxford's door in particular, but, you know, it is always true that universities tend to say, well, it's the early years education, it's something, you know, these widening participation issues are very, very difficult for us to deal with at the point that, you know, they come across our threshold. There may be some truth in that, but actually we've known about this for such a long time that universities must surely have been able to get to grips with that and actually, you know, come up with strategies for earlier interventions to actually, you know, start to have the impact that they all say they want to have in terms of transforming life chances and so on. And there's no getting away from the figures on particularly black and ethnic minority student enrolments at Oxford and Cambridge. They're absolutely atrocious, and they, you know, I think they're pretty shameful. So it's good to see David Lammy being such a, you know, taking such a strong line on this and trying to force the pace.
Indeed, 82% of offers by Oxford and Cambridge went to applicants from the top two social classes. I mean, I think that's between 2010 and 2015.
And that's increasing as well.
And that's increasing.
The proportion of offers going to those students.
Indeed, we're pushed for time. I said, you know, that we would mention how the US universities might have some lessons for UK universities on this, and that's something that Lammy alludes to.
Yeah, he talks about how Yale and Harvard, you know, offer, you know, they actually really seek out these students who have come from these poorer backgrounds but have the aptitude to do well in these institutions. You know, they knock on the doors of the local authorities and ask, who are your most capable students? We want to offer them a fully paid scholarship. He says, why are we not doing that in the UK?
Quite.
It's interesting, just to add to that, I mean, because I've had a look at a little bit of the data on this from our US college ranking. And what is interesting about that, though, is that although US universities do very well when it comes to kind of BME representation, especially, you know, for the Ivy League and the top end, if you look at social class, no, they still don't do very well. Mm-hmm. So what they're in effect doing is basically recruiting black and ethnic minority students from the higher social classes a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. The other thing as well with Oxford and Cambridge, of course, colleges have a large amount of autonomy, and actually their performance is quite probably, well, without looking at the detail, I couldn't actually swear to this, but I imagine that their performance will be quite variable. So Lady Margaret Hall, for example, which is now headed by Alan Rusbridge, has made some really quite sort of innovative steps, introducing foundation years to try and, you know, find ways of bridging the gap to actually do something about this in a much greater pace than has been in the past. So there is some really interesting ideas and some new approaches going on, but the headline figures aren't great.
Indeed. Well, you can read about that in the magazine and on the website as well, of course. Finally, before we go, and quite quickly given the time, Simon, you mentioned the US college rankings. This week we publish the Global University Employability Rankings. It looks at which university's employers name when thinking about the sort of most employable graduates, the people they want to give jobs to. What have you found digging through this data?
Yeah, so every year there's a company based in France that does this survey. They ask employers all over the world, hundreds of employers, what they feel are the best universities for employability. But also there's a theme every year to the survey where they ask them about, this year we've looked at digital skills and whether universities are preparing the next generation of graduates well for the changing nature of work. So there's some interesting results there. I mean, overall, just quickly, probably the headline thing about the ranking is that the UK has not come out of it very well this year. Mm. The US has kind of a mixed result. Some of its more well-known institutions sort of are down. But the UK has sort of suffered for all its universities fell, actually.
Every single one?
Yeah, every single one. Most well-known universities only fell a few places, except Oxford, actually, which fell back about a few more places, down from down to 15th, I think. So it fell 7 or 8 places.
Yeah,
I think.
From 7th.
But there were some other universities that fell like almost 50 places from the UK. And given this is sort of a survey of employers and is going to be largely based on their sort of reputational view of universities, that kind of does lead you to sort of jump on Brexit. Is that, you know, is the sort of view of the UK being tarnished in some way?
That's a pretty major fall, isn't it? So you're looking for a major incident in the last year, then you probably don't need to.
Well, the UK universities in this survey have been falling for some time. That's a product of the Asian universities relatively improving every year as places in China and Singapore and South Korea become more well-known. Some of these institutes become more well-known. They're more likely to be mentioned by employers as places producing good graduates. But there's also the kind of factor of the UK. We have more of a tradition of trying to produce graduates, especially in research-intensive universities, with a more rounded kind of transferable skill aspect, where they're, you know, not necessarily not necessarily concentrating on technical skills that some other systems might do, like Germany or France, and that's a reason as well. But I mean, that can't explain everything, and Emerging who did the survey do suggest that, you know, there is a view of the UK since the referendum that, you know, we're less welcoming, less of an outward looking country, and who knows if that's actually feeding into the view of our universities by employers abroad.
Indeed, and I can see you're desperate to tell listeners as well that there's an interactive table on this feature.
I wasn't actually, but thanks for mentioning it. Yeah, there is. Yeah, you can go online and search the ranking by country, by university. Yeah, so it's much more user-friendly than in the past.
Indeed, and on our student pages as well, we've taken those country rankings and reproduced those individually, so you can look through the way that universities are perceived in Australia, in America, in the UK, and so on. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, you can do so at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on LinkedIn. Just search for us on there. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.